In the name of God, most gracious, most compassionate. The topic of my discussion is trust in God. Trusting God is a core value in all world religions. Perhaps trusting God is even on a par with faith itself. Faith and trust in God are two sides of the same coin. One cannot exist without the other. They always go hand in hand. World religions, especially Abrahamic religions of Judaism, Christianity, and Islam, teach that we should rely on God's wisdom, God's love, strength, and ability. They teach that we can be confident that God makes good on His promises. Yet, I submit to you that most of us have a hard time grasping the true meaning of trusting God, let alone living by it. I think this difficulty is partly inherent in the very notion of trust. Why? Because, by and large, the attributes we rely on God for, such as knowledge, strength, ability, and so forth, we also have those attributes as well, albeit on a much lower scale. So, if we put our trust in God, does it mean that we should abandon our own talents and abilities in addressing our needs? Let's say if I use my own talents and abilities, then what am I trusting God for? What is the difference between me as a person of faith, as a truster in God, with somebody who does not believe in God, who does not trust in God? What is the difference between the two of us? Well, we both go to a doctor when we get sick. We both rely on science, technology. We both rely on the collective human brain power to solve our problems. Where and how does trust in God show itself for a person who believes in God and a non-believer? What is the difference? How does the difference show itself? These are tough questions. And I hope that this presentation would shed some light on these issues. This is what I will cover in my presentation. I will begin with a brief introduction to the concept of trusting God as it is discussed in theology. Then I will spend some time discussing the various dimensions of trusting God. For example, trusting God as a religious belief, its impact in practice and in behavior of a believer, and also its impact on the inner life of a person of faith. And finally, at the end of the presentation, I will discuss the levels of trusting God. As we will see, trusting God, very similar to faith, can be weak or it can be very strong. So basically, this is what I'm going to discuss in my presentation. Let me talk about trusting God in theological discourse. The Arabic word for trusting God is tawakkul. Tawakkul, which is a term that is used heavily in the Holy Quran, in English it means trusting God. Tawakkul comes from the root word wakala. Wakala has many meanings. It means to entrust, to dispose affairs, to lean on somebody or to rely on somebody. These are all the different meanings of wakala from which the word tawakkul is derived. In this presentation, whenever I refer to trusting God, in the Islamic context, I mean tawakkul. So tawakkul and trust in God for our purposes in this presentation, they are interchangeable. Trusting God is actually an umbrella concept for some key principles and key teachings in all Abrahamic faiths, including Islam. Let me talk about three concepts, three key teachings that are all interrelated with trusting God. The first concept related to trusting God is refuge and shelter. The Quran instructs Muslims that they should take refuge to God. For example, in chapter 23, verses 97 and 98, we read the following. وَقُلْ رَبِّ أَعُوذُ بِكَ مِنْ هَمَزَاتِ الشَّيَاطِينِ. Say, Lord, I take refuge with you from the goading of the evil ones. I seek refuge with you, Lord, so that they may not come near me. There are many other verses in the Quran where this notion of refuge and shelter in God is emphasized. The question is this: what do believers shelter in God from? Well, there are hostile elements out there that threaten us. Some of these hostile elements are concealed, some are evident. Some are disguised, while others are very obvious. Nonetheless, all of these elements, all of these hostile elements, can do harm with their evil designs and temptations. If we do not have a sanctuary in life, our sanity and faith will be in danger. If we do not have a sanctuary, our ethical and spiritual well-being will be in peril. So, taking refuge with God is an attempt to escape from these temptations and perils. The second interrelated concept in Arabic is called tafwidh. Tafwidh, if we translate it into English, it means to entrust anyone with an affair, to give jurisdiction, to confide with somebody. It also means to give full power to somebody. All of these terms mean tafwidh in Arabic. Obviously, giving jurisdictions, confiding with somebody, giving full power to somebody, they all imply trust, obviously. For example, in chapter 40 of the Holy Quran, there is the story of a man who abandoned the Pharaoh and joined Moses. His old friends were trying very hard to lure him back, so they would always go and argue with him. This newcomer to the flock of Moses would tell his old friends the following: وَأُوَفِّذُ أَمْرِي إِلَى اللَّهِ إِنَّ اللَّهَ بَصِيرٌ بِالْعِبَادِ. I commit my affair to God. I commit my affair to God. God is well aware of his servants. So God saved him from their evil schemes. In other words, this man had a heartfelt conviction that God would suffice for him. God was all the protection that he needed. So he committed his affair to him rather than accommodating the demands of disbelief. I think this verse in the Quran, chapter 65, verse 3, says it the best. وَمَنْ يَتَوَكَّلْ عَلَى اللَّهِ فَهُوَ حَسْبُهُ. God will be enough for those who put their trust in him. There is a third relate that teaching or principle to trusting God, which in Arabic is isti'anah. Isti'anah in English means to call for assistance, to turn to someone for help, to seek aid. In their daily prayers, numerous times Muslims turn to God for assistance by saying, إِيَّاكَ نَعْبُدُ وَإِيَّاكَ نَسْتَعِينَ. It is you we worship. It is you we ask for help. This is what Muslims ask of God numerous times in their daily prayers. It is you we worship. It is you we ask for help. I submit to you that you will only ask someone for help if you believe he is trustworthy, if you have a deep conviction that he is able and willing to lend a helping hand. So, to make it short, trusting God encapsulates all these three important teachings and notions: taking refuge to God, giving control to God, and seeking assistance from God. Trusting God incorporates all of these three notions. So, when we say we have trust in God, it means, number one, God is our ultimate sanctuary. Number two, that we relinquish our mind's control over all situations. We relinquish our control over all situations to God. And number three, we only call upon God to ask for help. We only call on Him to send help. If you remember, I said earlier that both believers and non-believers seek help from a doctor when they get sick. Do you remember that? They both rely on a physician's knowledge and abilities when they get sick. In other words, both groups, believers and non-believers, both use doctors as a means to stay healthy. Now, the question is this: if both the believers and non-believers rely on physicians and doctors to get well, what is the difference between them? Well, the answer is this: their view of means are different. Let me reiterate. Believers and non-believers have different views about means. In the outside world, there are many, many means and resources. We utilize these means in order to achieve our goals. For example, when we want to achieve good health, not only we see physicians, but we also buy health insurance. We take vitamins on a daily basis. These are all means we can rely on to be healthy. What are some other means we employ every day? Well, books are also means to acquire knowledge. Airplanes, cars, they are all means for transportation. Computers, the banking system, government bureaucracy, these are all means we can employ to reach our objectives. For a believer, however, there is a single hand operating behind all these means. All the diverse means that exist in the world out there, a believer sees a single hand operating behind all of them. All means have their origin in a single source, God. God is Musabbibul Asbab. God is the producer of all means. Musabbibul Asbab. In other words, all means, instruments, and resources owe their efficacy to God. Until and unless God grants permission, nothing will be effective in producing a result. I guess this saying of Muslim mystics is very descriptive. لا مؤثر في الوجود إلا الله. لا مؤثر في الوجود إلا الله. The only effective force in all existence is God. In other words, everything that has effect, be it energy, medication, medical devices, anything that has effect owes its effectiveness to God. This is the mindset of a believer. For this reason, a believer does not rely on any means per se. He doesn't trust the means, but he trusts the source that grants effect to all the means, because the means are just intermediaries. So this is the mindset of a believer. A believer does not have faith in means, instruments, and resources. He always sees the hands of God producing effects in this world. So this is basically the difference in the viewpoint of a believer versus a non-believer when it comes to means. Let me now address a prevalent misunderstanding about trusting God. This is a very common misunderstanding, misconception, and I think it behooves us to clear this misconception. There are actually two aspects to this misconception and misunderstanding, and I would like to address both aspects. You see, in all religious communities, amongst Jews, Christians, and Muslims, there have always been folks for whom trusting God has meant inaction. For them, trusting God has always meant inaction. As they see it, there is a contradiction between trusting God and human initiative. As far as they're concerned, there is a disharmony between trusting God and human planning and action. Either we trust God or we trust ourselves. They see an inherent contradiction between trusting God and trusting human abilities and capabilities. Some Muslim Sufis, for example, would wander into desert without taking any food or water. Why? They would argue that taking food and water in a journey implies that they had misgivings about God's ability to provide for them. It would be a sign of weakness in their trust in God. The other day I found this piece on the internet that I think pretty much explains the attitude of this group of people who see a contradiction between trusting God and human initiative. Apparently, this article was posted on the internet by a Christian fellow. He starts off with asking a question. Isn't it reasonable to trust good Christian experts like doctors and counselors? Doesn't God work through them? Then he elaborates further. When Jesus was on earth and someone came to him for healing, he never once said, "Go see Luke I heal through doctors. Luke obviously was a physician. Instead, Jesus healed the person directly, either through his word, which we have today in the form of the Bible, or he healed them through natural methods such as clay or water. Many Christians believe that God gave us doctors, so therefore we should use them. Just because doctors are present on earth, we cannot automatically assume that God wants us to use them. The mere presence of various other groups of people on earth, such as thieves, prostitutes, murderers, and so forth, doesn't in any way suggest that God wants us to employ their services. Did you follow his reasoning? He's basically saying that we cannot rely on doctors and counselors to resolve our issues and our problems if we are to trust God. A person who relies on the abilities and services of other fellow human beings does not truly trust God. We can find folks with this sort of attitude all around us, in all of our diverse religious communities. They would not do their homework when they want to get married. Instead, they go on the advice of friends and relatives, and they call it trusting God. When in fact, this is trust in their friends and relatives' opinion, not God. Or some people sit on the rear end hoping that someday God would drop the perfect mate on their lap. Still, some folks do not take any initiative to upgrade their skills to find a job, trusting that God will ultimately provide for them. I believe this attitude does not jive well with the overall teachings of all the Abrahamic religions, Islam, Christianity, Judaism, and so forth. These folks who see a contradiction between trusting God and human initiative, I believe they have a one-sided view of things. This is a gross misunderstanding of what authentic trust in God is. I think Rumi got it right when he said, گر توکل می کنی در کار کن، کشت کن پس تکی بر جبار کن. If you are putting trust in God, put trust in Him as regards your work. Sow the seed, then rely upon the Almighty. کشت کن پس تکی بر جبار کن. Sow the seed, then rely upon the Almighty. In other words, put your trust in God after sowing the seed, not beforehand. Trusting God should never be mistaken with laziness and inaction. Rumi perhaps got his cue from a verse in the Quran, which I believe so clearly shows the true meaning of trusting God. This verse is actually directed at the Prophet Muhammad. I think it really shows the essence of what authentic and trusting God is all about. وَشَاوِرْهُمْ فِي الْأَمْرِ فَإِذَا عَذَمْتَ فَتَوَكَّلْ عَلَى اللَّهِ إِنَّ اللَّهَ يُحِبُّ الْمُتَوَكِّلِينَ. Consult with the people about matters. Remember, this verse is directed at Prophet Muhammad. Consult with the people about matters. Then, when you have decided on a course of action, put your trust in God. God loves those who put their trust in Him. Did you notice the order of commandments in this verse? The order is absolutely critical in this verse. First, وَشَاوِرُهُمْ فِي الْأَمْرِ Consult. What does consultation mean? Well, in contemporary language, it basically means go do your homework. Come up with a prudent course of action. Do not rush into action blindly. Then, number two, فَإِذَا أَذَمْتَ Look deep inside to muster a resolve. Come up with a solid resolve to carry your decision through. Muster a solid resolve to implement the decision that so laboriously you have come up with. And last, put your trust in God. Well, I submit to you, we tend to skip the first two steps and jump directly to the very last part, don't we? We tend not to do our homework. We don't muster a solid resolve. We just say we trust in God when we want to do something. You see, God has never asked that we should let Him act on our behalf. God has never asked that we should let Him do work on our behalf. God has provided us with reason, with enormous faculties and capabilities. He expects us to put these faculties and capacities to use prudently every single day to take care of our own affairs. If we do not use our God-given talents and potentials, I believe this is a sign of ungratefulness. It is a sign of ungratefulness. We have actually a concept in the Holy Quran which is very important in our religious ethics, and it's in Arabic, it is shukr, or gratitude, gratefulness. You see, the deeper meaning of gratitude or shukr is putting our talents and resources to the best use. If God has given you talents, potentials, if you do not make good use of those talents and resources, you are really ungrateful. You are not showing gratitude to God. So the bottom line is this. If we want to be grateful of all the capacities and talents that God has given us, well, we have to put them to good use. So putting them into good use is a Quranic instruction, is a Quranic commandment. God wants us to use our reason, our faculties and capabilities. He doesn't want us to make them go to waste. So the bottom line is this. Not only there is not a contradiction between trusting God and human initiative, planning and action, quite the contrary. A key component, a key ingredient of trusting God is basically using our own initiative and resources. That is a Quranic commandment to the Prophet Muhammad. Do your homework, muster a solid resolve to carry your plan forward and implement your plan, and at the end, put your trust in God. There is a second aspect to this misunderstanding about trusting God that I would like to address. You see, it is true that there are matters that God has left their management to us. But there are also matters that are strictly reserved for God to manage. There are matters for us to manage, and there are matters that are reserved for God to manage. That area is off limits to men and women of faith. people of faith should trust God with their management. Just let me give you a couple of examples of matters and things whose management should be left to God. The first example is guidance. Let me point to a verse in the Holy Quran which so eloquently make this point very clear. Chapter 28, verse 56. This verse is also directed at the Prophet Muhammad. You, Prophet, cannot guide everyone you love to the truth. It is God who guides whoever he will. It is God who guides whoever he will. He knows best those who will follow guidance. In other words, trusting God means we should leave guidance to God. No one has any authority from God to force a religion onto others. Those who want to take ownership of other people's guidance, they have no trust in God. That's what this verse means. The second example has to do with guardianship over faith and the faithful. Chapter 6, verse 107. This verse again is directed at the Prophet Muhammad. We have not made you, the unbeliever's guardian, nor are you their keeper. Isn't that amazing? God instructs the Prophet that he has not made the Prophet the unbeliever's guardian, nor he is their keeper. There is another verse in the Quran that makes the same point. Chapter 88, verse 21 and 22. So, Prophet, remind them, your only task is to deliver this reminder. You are not there to control them. Now, unfortunately, we as followers of these prophets of God tend to go in the opposite direction. When it comes to finding a spouse or a job, when it comes to taking care of our own finances, for example, we leave their management to God. We ask God to do those things on our behalf. But when it comes to religious guidance, we feel obligated to do God's work. And sometimes very brutally, by imposing our opinions on others as the word of God. So, this is the second aspect of this misconception about trusting God. In a nutshell, if I were to summarize all of this, some folks don't pull their own weight and they call this laziness trusting God. Yet, they play God all the time. They pretend to be God's lieutenants on earth. They want to decide who has faith, who doesn't. They want to decide who will go to heaven, who will go to hell. They extend their reach into God's rightful territory. This sort of behavior is the prime example of not trusting God. So let's clear the misunderstanding. True meaning of trusting God is leave God's work to God, not your work to God. Leave God's work to God, not your work to God. Now, let me spend a few minutes to talk about how trusting God impacts the state of mind and emotions of a person of faith. As I said before, trusting God has a belief component. However, It is not just an abstract idea or declaration of theory. If trusting God is fully understood, if it is internalized, it will have great impacts on our state of mind, on our psyche and emotions. Let me point out three of these impacts, these so-called mental or psychological impacts of trusting God. The first impact is that trusting God enables us to overcome our indecision and doubts. Trusting God enables us to overcome our indecision. You might ask, how? How does trusting God empower us to overcome our doubts and indecision? I guess Rumi has the answer for us. He points out a personality trait that many of us have, and that personality trait exacerbates indecision. That personality trait in Farsi is called hazar, or excessive caution in English. Excessive caution. Here is Rumi. در هزار شوریدن شور و شر است، رو توکل کن، توکل بهتر است. In extreme caution is the embroilment of broil and woo. Put your trust in God. Trusting God is better. In other words, Rumi says that extreme caution is the embroilment of a woo. It can cripple our resolve for action. It's a personality trait. You can think, analyze, and plan all you want, but it is nearly impossible to predict the outcome. Sometimes we are indecisive. We don't act because we think we have not analyzed enough, because we don't know what the outcome is going to be. So regardless of how much analysis you've done, regardless of how much planning you've done, it is nearly impossible to predict the outcome. Why, you might ask? Because not everything is under your control. There are another 7 billion unpredictable folks out there with their own plans. Your plan and their plans may not be always in line. So those 7 billion folks will create obstacles in your path. I guess what I'm trying to say is this. The fear of unknown, a lack of certainty about the desired outcome of our plans, they can easily shake our resolve for action. The risks, the difficulties, the challenges, they can all give us cold feet. But a person of faith would say, I have done my homework. I've done my homework. I will act and leave the rest to God. God will see that my actions will bear fruit. God will see to it that my actions will be fruitful. Even if I don't know all the details, there is an all-knowing God. There is an all-seeing, all-loving God who is watching over me. He will not leave me alone with my own difficulties in times of need. He will come to my rescue. This is the mindset of a believer. A believer has this very deep conviction that there are very powerful, very effective forces in this world that would come to his aid. This attitude, I submit to you, is quite reassuring. It's a very empowering psychological boost. There's a caveat, though, and this is a very important caveat. Yes, there are very powerful forces out there in the world that will come to the rescue and assistance of a person of faith. They will come to my assistance when I pray to God, when I trust God. However, I should swim in the direction of the river, not against it. If I want the forces of nature to assist me in my swimming, to push me forward, well, I better be swimming in the direction of the water and the river, not against it. In other words, my plans should not contradict divine words. My plans should not contradict divine values. I can't go stealing and pray that God would come to my help. It just doesn't work that way. So, in a nutshell, trusting God enables us to overcome our crippling doubts, to let go of our fears so we can go into action, we can implement our decisions. This is the first fruit of trusting God. The second fruit of trusting God is quite important: inner peace after setbacks. Let me explain. You see, when we put our trust in God, we leave matters in God's hands. Let me repeat. When we put our trust in God, we leave matters in God's hands. Well, the question is this: what does it mean to leave matters in God's hands? Essentially, it means that we leave the outcome of our action to God. We leave the outcome to God. Whether the outcome is favorable or not, it will not ruin our state of mind. Irrespective of the outcome, whether it is favorable or not, it will not ruin our composure, our inner peace. If things do not work out as we planned or hoped, we will not cry out. We will not have self-pity. We will not fight with ourselves, saying, "That was stupid. I should have never done that. It was a waste of time. Why did I do that?" A person of faith who leaves matters to God would never say such a thing. So, trusting God requires that we should be at peace with the outcome. This is very critical. Let me repeat one more time. Trusting God requires that we should be at peace with the outcome. We should be content with how things turn out because we left the outcome in God's hands. So, the second fruit of trusting God is inner peace after setbacks. A person of faith will not be depressed or emotionally ruined just because things did not work out as she desired. There is a third fruit of trusting God, which is very important as well, and that is courage under fire. Courage under fire. The Quran is full of stories of prophets who went head to head against superpowers of their time. Moses was one of these messengers of God. He embarked on a daring mission against the Pharaoh. The Pharaoh was truly the superpower of that era. Moses went on a daring mission against the Pharaoh. What was his ammunition? Obviously, when you go into a fight, you better have enough ammo with you. You have to be well equipped. What was the ammunition of Moses when he went against the Pharaoh? Oddly enough, a wooden rod and a divine promise. There were just two things he had as ammo with him: a wooden rod and a divine promise. What was that divine promise? Moses, you shall prevail. You shall prevail. That was God's promise to Moses. Well, his trust in God's promise fueled his mission. That divine promise gave Moses an immense positive energy, something that kept him going even when the going was unbelievably rough and fearsome. He would just keep going because of his deeply felt conviction that God will deliver on his promise. Because God had promised Moses that ultimately at the end, you shall prevail. Don't fear the Pharaoh. Don't fear the size of the obstacle in front of you. Trust me. You have my backing. Here is a verse from the Quran that I believe articulates what prophets and messengers of God would say to disbelievers who wanted to harm them. وَلَنَّسْبِرَنَّ عَلَى مَا عَزَيْتُمُونَ وَعَلَى اللَّهِ فَلْيَتَوَكَّلِ الْمُتَوَكِّلُونَ. Why should we not put our trust in God when it is He who has guided us to this way we follow? We shall certainly bear steadfastly whatever harm you do to us. Let anyone who trusts, trust in God. So, in other words, they had full confidence in God's promise of assistance, that God would never abandon them. God basically made a promise to his messengers that the good and the truth will always prevail. The good and the truth shall always prevail. This is how God designed this world. Actually, there are a few verses in the Quran to that effect, that this entire cosmos was created, was founded on the truth. In other words, falsehood will never go far. Falsehood will never prevail at the end. Those who are on the right side of any issue, those who are on the right side of history, in other words, those who are on the side of God's commandments and values, they shall prevail. So, trusting God means trusting God's promises. This conviction is very empowering. It produces courage to face uncertainties. It produces courage to face uncertainties and adversities in life. So, these were three of the important impacts, psychological impacts of trusting God. A person of faith who deeply trusts God will enjoy these fruits. This is how the inner life of a person of faith will be impacted by her trust in God. We are getting close to the end of this presentation, so let me spend a few minutes talking about the different levels of trusting God. As I said earlier, trust and faith are intertwined. Trust and faith are intertwined, and they always go hand in hand. You see, faith is a personal relationship with God. As this relationship matures, as it deepens, we will seamlessly, very seamlessly feel that we have an abundance of trust in God. Very naturally, without any efforts, without any brainwashing or any force, we suddenly feel that we have an abundance of trust in God. When will that happen? When our faith, our relationship with God matures and deepens. So, very similar to faith, our confidence and trust in God can grow or weaken over the course of our lives. It can go in either direction. It can either grow or shrink. We may have positive and promising life experiences that strengthen our faith and our trust in God. Positive experiences strengthen our faith and trust in God. For example, recovery from a very serious illness, such as cancer, will definitely give us hope that God is there to save us. What are some other positive and promising life experiences? Well, having good children, healthy children, financial fortunes, promotion in a job. These positive experiences tend to strengthen our trust in God. But the opposite is also true. We may have negative experiences that will weaken our faith and trust in God. See, one of the downsides to these negative experiences in life is that they tend to weaken our faith and trust in God. For example, death of a loved one, especially death of a child, has that kind of negative impact on our faith. A serious illness such as cancer, personal or financial calamities, they are all negative experiences, and very often they lead to a weakening of faith and trust in God. According to Muslim mystics, there are at least three levels of trust. So just think of trust as a spectrum. On the one end of the spectrum, there is no trust at all. Then you have weak trust, medium trust, and then all the way to very strong and full trust in God. But according to Muslim mystics, there are at least three major levels of trust. I guess it is easier to describe the differences between these three levels if I use an example for each of them. The first level of trust, which is the weakest, is like the trust that a client puts in her attorney. Let's say Jane has a court case. She looks around for an attorney with a great track record. And after doing her homework, Jane hires that attorney. Now, since she is confident about his knowledge and experience, Jane will rely on that attorney in court. And there is a catch here, though. Jane's trust in her attorney is conditional. It's conditional. You see, we never give a blank check to an attorney, do we? For that reason, Jane doesn't do so either. She doesn't give a blank check to her attorney. Her trust in her attorney is conditional. You see, at the end of the hour, Jane and the attorney are two individuals with different motives, different interests, different viewpoints, and different wills. Furthermore, Jane can always release the attorney. Jane can always drop the attorney and opt for another one. You see, a person of faith may have this sort of confidence in God, this sort of partial and conditional trust in God. In this case, the person's trust in God is obviously not all that much. The person is always ultimately in control, not God. The person is in control, not God. This sort of trust in God is actually the kind of trust that the majority of religious folks put in God. The second level of trust is stronger, but fewer people ever reach that level. This level of trust is like the trust that a baby has in her mother. Let's say my 2-year-old daughter, Ariana. See, Ariana instinctively seeks her mom all the time. All the time, she looks to her mom for help and assistance. In reality, mom is Ariana's refuge. Mom is Ariana's shelter. Pretty much, Ariana totally relies on mom for everything. Since Ariana has complete confidence in mom's love and goodwill, she will pretty much eat and drink everything mom puts in her mouth. See, Ariana will never say, "Mom, is this milk or poison you just put in my mouth? Could you check the expiration date to make sure that this milk is not bad?" See, this thought never crosses Ariana's mind. She would never say anything like that. You see, a number of believers would have this level of trust in God. A small number will have this sort of trust in God. This group does not question God's love and goodwill, just as Ariana never questions her mom's love and goodwill. That's why this group embraces all life situations, comforts and discomforts, gracefully. This group will embrace all life situations gracefully. I guess Rumi's experience in this regard is quite telling. یک لحظه داغم می کشی، یک دم به باغم می کشی، پیش چراغم می کشی تا وا شود چشمان من. هفت آسمان را بردرم و از هفت دریا بگذرم، گر دل برانه بنگری در جان سرگردان من. One moment you burn me. He's obviously talking to the beloved, to God. One moment you burn me. The next moment you take me to a rose garden. You drag me under the lamp to open my eyes. This is quite illuminating. Very descriptive. You see, as far as Rumi is concerned, the hardships and comforts in life, the misfortunes and fortunes in life that are sent by God, they essentially serve exactly the same purpose. What is the purpose? To open our eyes. To open our eyes so we can see better. So all life challenges, all the adversities, as well as positive experiences, they all tend to have exactly the same outcome for the folks who are at this second level of trust. At this level, yes, there is still full awareness of separation. You see, Ariana knows and feels she is not one with her mom. This is very critical. Let me repeat one more time. even though Aryana has full trust in mom's love and goodwill, still she doesn't feel that she is one with her mom. And this is also true for the folks who are at this second level of trusting God. They fully understand, they know and feel that they are not one with God, with divine. The third level of trust is quite rare, but it is attainable. As rare as it is, it's still attainable. The best example that I can give you that hopefully will shed light on this highest level of trust is the example of a pen in a writer's hand. Just picture in your head. Picture a pen in a writer's hand. The pen does not move on its own. The pen has absolutely no design of its own. It pretty much moves as the writer wishes. The pen seamlessly, effortlessly, naturally moves as the writer wishes. In other words, the pen is just like a vehicle. It's a vehicle in the capable hands of the writer to write as he pleases. It shows no resistance. Have you ever seen a pen that shows resistance when you want to write with it? No, it never does. The pen does not resist. It just goes with the flow. You remember in the second level of trust, there is still a clear sense of separation. There is a sense of duality. Aryana and her mom, there are two distinct individuals. It is just that when Aryana needs something, where does she turn to for help? Her mom. Because she has full confidence that mom is there to help. In the third level, however, there is no sense of separation. There is no duality anymore. The pen has no independent will. The pen has no independent desire. The mystics call this stage fana. Fana. In English, fana means self-annihilation. Self-annihilation. Sometimes it's translated into English also as unification or self-realization. All of these basically mean fana. Self-annihilation, self-realization, or unification. Fana is the climax of the spiritual journey where eternal union with divine or love is achieved. At this highest stage of the spiritual journey, any sense, any perception of one's self is lost. Let me repeat, at the end of this spiritual journey, any perception or sense of one's self is lost. A sense of total integration with divine is now experienced. This is what fana is all about. To illustrate the highest level of trust, Rumi, in his masterpiece, Mathnavi, tells the story of a linguist and a boatman. This is a very instructive and useful story that Rumi has, and I think it really sheds light on the notion of fana or self-annihilation and the accompanying highest level of trust in God. In this story, the linguist or the grammarian is the symbol of disbelief. The linguist is a non-believer, somebody who exclusively relies on his own abilities. He only trusts himself. He thinks that his own potential, abilities, and capabilities are sufficient for him. He doesn't need to rely on anybody or any other thing. The boatman, on the other hand, is a symbol of the highest degree of trust. Again, the boatman is somebody who has reached the climax of the spiritual journey, which is fana, or self-annihilation and unification. Here is the story. آن یکی نحوی به کشتی در نشست، رو به کشتی بان نهاد آن خود پرست. گفت هیچ از نحو خواندی؟ گفت لا. گفت نیم عمر تو شد در فنا. A certain grammarian embarked in a boat. The self-conceited person turned to the boatman and said, Have you ever studied grammar? No, he replied. The grammarian said, Half your life is gone to naught. Half your life is gone to naught, or waste, basically. In other words, the linguist asked the boatman, Do you know grammar? And he said, No. And then the linguist said, Well, in that case, you've wasted half of your life. دل شکسته گشت کشتیبان ز تاب، لیک آن دم کرد خاموش از جواب. باد کشتی را به گردابی فکند، گفت کشتیبان بدان نحوی بلند. هیچ دانی آشنا کردن بگو، گفت نی اش خوش جواب خوب رو. گفت کل عمرت این نحوی فناست، زن که کشتی غرق این گرداب هاست. The boatman became heartbroken with grief, but at the time he refrained from answering. The wind cast the boat into a whirlpool. The boatman shouted to the grammarian, Tell me, do you know how to swim? No, said he, O fair-spoken, good-looking man. O grammarian, said the boatman, your whole life is naught, because the boat is sinking in these whirlpools. You remember the grammarian told the boatman that half your life has gone to waste because you don't know grammar. When the boat hit a whirlpool, it was now the boatman's turn to pay back the linguist. He said, You were just about to lose all your life. Your life is going to go to a waste because we are hitting such a fearsome storm and the boat is going to sink in these whirlpools. Now, Rumi unveils this moral of the story. Now, before I read the final verse to you, let me make a point here. Here, Rumi refers to mahv, and it basically means total integration, total disappearance of an entity in a bigger being. Think of a drop of water. When a drop of water joins the ocean, what happens? That drop disappears in that vast ocean. That's what mahv is all about. In a sense, mahv and fana, or self-annihilation, are interchangeable here. Here is the moral of the story according to Rumi. Mahv mi bayad na nahv inja bedan gar to mahvi bi khatar dar ab ran. محف می باید نه نحف اینجا بدان گر تو محوی بی خطر در آب ران. Know that here محف or self-annihilation is needed, not grammar. Know that here محف is needed, not grammar. If you are محف, plunge into the sea without peril. The water of the sea places the dead one on its head, cause him to float on the surface. But if he be living, how shall he escape from the sea? Such a fascinating analogy that Rumi uses here. Did you pick it up? He used the analogy of a person that is struggling to stay afloat at sea. Rumi says, the water of the sea places this person on top of the water. When? When that person dies. Mah, right? Self-annihilation. Only when the person dies, then he will rise above the water. It's a paradox, isn't it? The person dies from one state of existence, a state of existence which is about separation from the source, from the divine, and then the person is reborn in a new state, in a more complete and fuller state, in union with the divine. According to this analogy of Rumi, only when the person lets go, he will rise over the top of the water. When he relinquishes control to water, meaning God, the water takes over and saves him from sinking below. That's what Mahv is all about. So just to say it, you know, in summary, Mahv or grammar in this example symbolizes a person's willpower, what he thinks he knows, his talents, his capacities, his capabilities. Now, in some life situations, obviously, these capacities and capabilities certainly will do. But in the whirlpools of life, they will not suffice. Mahv, on the other hand, is a state of union with God. It is achieved after complete existential surrender and submission. Once this sort of complete surrender, complete submission, integration with the divine is achieved, only at this stage, full trust in God will appear. In other words, full trust in God is a byproduct of this union. People, the elite, who successfully complete this spiritual journey, who achieve this state of complete submission and surrender, a state of union with the divine, these are the folks who will experience the highest degree of trust in God. They will have the strongest possible trust and confidence in God. So that's the third stage, and as I mentioned, it is quite rare. Let me emphasize a couple of points here. The three levels of trust that I just mentioned really reflect a believer's inner life, how a person feels and perceives. There is nothing in the person's outer behavior that an onlooker would observe and say, aha, this person is at the first level of trust or at the third level of trust. There is nothing in the outer behavior of a person of faith that can tell us at which level of trust he is. It's all about inner life, how the person feels and perceives. Now, secondly, as I mentioned, the average believer on the street is at the first level. The great majority of us have, you know, just that first level of trust in God, which is very partial and conditional. The second and the third levels are more difficult to reach. Well, I guess I've talked enough in this presentation, and let me close with a verse from a poem and by Hafez, one of the greatest Iranian mystics. I think nobody can say it better than him. تکیه بر تقوا و دانش در طریقت کافری است. راه رو گر صد هنر دارد توکل بایدش. Reliance on righteousness and knowledge is disbelief. Reliance on righteousness and knowledge is disbelief. Having 100 talents, still the disciple should put his trust in God. So, as Hafez said, our sense of righteousness is not enough. Our relative goodness, a head full of knowledge, 100 talents, none of them is a substitute for trust in God. I hope that this presentation shed some light on the complexities of the notion of trust in God. Thank you very much for your attention, and God bless you.